Variations on a Theme by Andrea Mantegna. 1. Pallas expelling the vices from the garden of virtue. In a garden, not Eve's, not Adam's, but like theirs, unmarred by history, marked by 11 arches, 4 focusing a low lattice fence that retains rose bushes escaping to climb and cluster at the top between the curves. A stone wall on the right defies time, which enters vigorously from the left. Pallas Athena, one hand clasping the shaft of a broken spear, the other raising her shield against a swarm of armed cupids. Helmeted, splendid in red, gold, white, and blue, she bursts through the arch. Clothed and unclothed figures scatter. Some flee on land, others through stagnant waters of a swamp moat. Avarice, a lean woman with spear-like breasts, leads the flight of vices through the swamp. She and ingratitude carry the fat crowned figure of ignorance. Behind them, a satyr clasps an infant and a bearskin. In the foreground, a monkey-like hermaphrodite, immortal hatred, fraud, and malice, looks back fearfully at Athena as he clutches his 4 seed bags of evil. Idleness, armless, naked, is pulled along with a rope by tatterdemalion sloth. Venus, off-center, her scant green scarf billowing about her, stands on the back of a centaur, while ahead Cupid raises his torches of love. 2 women in green and blue who carry a bow, Diana, and an extinguished torch of chastity, lead the approach to Venus. Tall as an arch, transforming into a tree with upraised branches, a greenish figure cries to the turbulent sky, "Come, divine companions of the virtues, who are returning to us from heaven, banish these foul monsters of vice from our seats." In a fleecy mandorla of clouds hover Temperance, who waters down her wine, Justice, with her scales and sword, and Fortitude, who holds a column and club and wears Hercules' lion skin. Below, immured in the garden wall, Prudence releases a little banderola, urging in Latin, "And you, O God, succor me, the mother of virtues." 2. Christopher Columbus. And somewhere in Mantegna's time, Cristoforo Colombo, a virtuous gentleman of Genoa, was going ashore in San Salvador in the Bahamas to take possession of Arawak land for Castile. Quote, "To win their friendship, and realizing that here was a people to be converted to our holy faith by love and friendship and not by force, I gave some of them red caps, glass beads, and many other little things. These pleased them very much, and they became very friendly. They later swam out to the ship's boats in which we were seated and brought us parrots and balls of cotton and spears. They willingly traded everything they owned. But they seemed to me a poor people, naked. Both men and women cried, 'Come and see the men who have come from heaven and bring them food and water.' Should your majesties command it, all the inhabitants could be taken away to Castile or made slaves on the island." Unquote. And when the Santa Maria foundered on a reef off Haiti, Guacanagare, the local chief or cacique, who had already met Columbus and sent him presents, including a gold mask, hearing of the misfortune, wept, quote, and sent me various of his relatives to implore me not to grieve, for he would give me everything he had, unquote. The Santa Maria ran aground on Christmas, wrenched from its wounded timbers, honoring Jesus' mother, Fort Navidad. Arawak's newly enslaved lifted hosannas of pain into its walls. Columbus planted his sailors like flags claiming the land for the rulers of Spain. On the Niña, Columbus gathered the rest of his crew. He rounded up the sample Arawak slaves and fired the Lombard at the carcass hull of his foundered ship, the Santa Maria, and set sail. Across the Atlantic, weather turning cold, the caravels leaked and shivering prisoners died. Week after week of anguish staggered on from phantom shores they thought that they had reached. The way, the truth of passage to the east, the gilded route to Orient Gold, Cathay. The turbulent journey over, in triumph, Columbus entered Barcelona. Six surviving Indians walked behind in feathers and little aprons, walked in the chilly air, waded through roaring mouths and glittering eyes. Admiral Columbus, hail! Portugal, Spain, blessed by the Pope, divided the spoils of the world. And so unleashed the snarling hunt for gold. 17 ships with 1,500 men set out to conquer savages, arrived at quiet Navidad and waited. Fearfully, men from the villages of Guacanagari visited by night with gifts. The admiral learned that the colony men had roamed the island in gangs, looking for gold and raping the women, and each of the colony men had been captured and killed. Now the Indians were made to surrender their golden ornaments, and every day they washed the gold dust from the streams as tribute to buy a 3-month copper coin. Without it, hands were hacked off, and they bled to death. Their pacification intact, the suicides began en masse. By 1540, Arawaks collapsed into archaeology. And still, there was no gold. There was no gold. No gold. 3. Vincennes. On July 3, 1988, an American warship shot down an Iranian airliner, killing 290 civilians. The Pentagon tried to cover the tragic blunder. Sea of Lies, Newsweek, July 13, 1992. Burst into burning blood came screaming down into the Persian Gulf and doubly drowned in a sea of lies. The anti-aircraft missiles launched into a yellow haze of sand from the Arabian desert. And the combat information center light dimmed like a prisoner's during an execution. I made the proper decision, said Captain Rogers, retiring to his cabin aboard the Vincennes. It was hot, and the captain was shaving. The frigate Montgomery, escorting Kuwaiti tankers, registered under the U.S. flag to keep the oil flowing, had spotted 13 Iranian gunboats in the Strait of Hormuz, milling about a Liberian tanker, the Stovall. Somebody heard explosions. Captain Rogers, on orders, sent a helicopter to inspect, but in addition sent a blast through the klaxon, rushing his crew to man their battle stations and move the ship north to Iranian waters. Omanis ordered Iranian gunboats to leave. Omanis ordered the warship Vincennes to leave. Captain McKenna, chief of surface warfare, also ordered the Vincennes to leave. Helicopter trailed the gunboats north, took anti-aircraft fire. The Vincennes moved north again, engaged Iranian gunboats within their 12-mile territorial limit. Iran Air Captain Mohsen Rezaian announced to the tower at Bandar Abbas Airport that he was ready for takeoff. Lifted the plane into the haze, unknowingly, over the Vincennes. Wearing his jaunty gold-encrusted cap, Captain Rogers, flanked by battle managers, sat upright in the womb of his cockpit at the darkened Combat Information Center, the windowless Combat Information Center, and directed warfare by remote control. The $400 million Aegis computer, with its 4 42-inch square screens relaying to rows of operators, each one studying an element of the battle, monitored on separate radio consoles. The Aegis computer can track every aircraft within 300 miles, identify them as friendly or hostile, display their direction and speed, rank them by danger. Flight 655, picked up on radar, was classified as commercial, but was missed by the petty officer on his list. A decision was passed along, part friction mixed with fear. Innocent aircraft in ascent, perceived as hostile in descent. Two SMZs shot into the haze. Captain Rezaian heard none of the warnings, reported he had reached his first checkpoint. "Have a nice day," the tower radioed. A missile blew off the plane's left wing. Enormous span with engine pod attached, it fell like Icarus into the sea. On the Montgomery, crewmen gaped in awe as Zeus rained blood and fragments of the sky, turning about the Vincennes left Iranian waters. The U.S. Navy claimed that the warship Vincennes had sped to defend the Stovall, an unarmed merchant ship. But that ship, a decoy to lure enemy gunboats into international waters, was a simulacrum of radio transmissions, a Pentagon experiment. The Stovall existed merely on a computer screen. 4. Epilogue. Pale against green water, face down, face up, bodies of women, men, and children float their quiet screams into the Persian Gulf. Past naked Arawaks, thrown overboard, past sailors drowned in long-forgotten wars. All bodies drowned may pass through the Strait of Hormuz. Pallas Athena is chasing the vices. Avarice, envy, sloth, fraud, and ignorance weighed in petroleum oil that thickens the sea. Athena drops her broken spear and doffs her helmet, brimming with golden grain to feed new life to the dead and to the living, while she guides their vivid spirits toward the garden of virtue, where vices thrash about in a swamp below the soaring, rose-tipped hedges bordering the garden and a low, compassionate sky. Part 7. Convergences. In Nairobi. Ah, Coricia, if there were 20 of you side by side with all your spines, and stands of Heliconia spread their beaks like birds of paradise in yellow and red, and bougainvillea bloomed atop the tallest flame tree, there still would rise the metal gates and fences, the sense one must be guarded behind a screen or double door. Day pours its sunlit gardens on stony streets, the people walking, walking. A barefoot runner pulls a cart of lumber past women carrying firewood, hunching their shoulders. Entrance to the city market swarms with mothers bearing babies in hungry arms, and a boy huffing claws at our car window. In the Tembo curio shop, an artist shows me logs, their bark to be stripped away to ebony hearts. Bells, masks, wooden sculptures, Makonde and Maasai, jewelry and spoons and spears in silence claim like lions a pride of recognition, pride that scales the walls and gates and blossoms free.